Mr. Stevens, a few years ago, there was a lot of hype about the Northwest Passage and Northeastern Sea Route becoming this alternative maritime highways. What happened to that?
Well, I think that there was a burst of enthusiasm, even hyperbole, as you say, driven by a couple of significant events. Obviously, the fact that the ice is melting, although there's a definite trend toward from more ice to less ice. But I think as people have drilled down on this, they found that it's a somewhat uneven phenomenon. One can't assume that, notwithstanding the trend, that it will mean in any given year at any given time that you can predict what's going to happen. There were also a couple of high-profile expeditions, I guess, or instances of products being shipped via the Arctic, or a couple of high-profile ships, the Nordic Orion being a particular case in point in Canada, and that caused a lot of interest, a flurry of interest. The media is always looking for things to write about. The whole issue of climate change is very much on people's minds, and there is no doubt there's an impact on the Arctic for that. And so there was, I think, a great flush of enthusiasm. The facts haven't really borne this out. In fact, shipping levels reached a peak, if you call it a peak, in 2013, and they dropped from there. And even at the peak, there were something like 70 vessels that transited the Northern Sea Route across Russia, far fewer in Canada. And we're seeing, I think, now the balloon to deflate somewhat, coming a little bit back to Earth, and people now taking a longer-term look at what really potentially can happen.
Now, even then, a few years ago, experts were warning that receding sea ice or melting sea ice would actually make some of the navigation even more dangerous, because it kind of frees up all that packed multi-year ice that's very dangerous for ships. Can you talk about some of the, physical challenges to shipping in those Arctic latitudes?
Yes. Now, I'm not a navigational expert, so I'm basing this on some of the research that I've done. But, I mean, there are many, and as you mentioned, obviously for many years these passages, particularly the Canadian passages, were completely closed. Now, with some melting, that has made passages, even the northern of the two routes, more open. But that doesn't mean that the challenges have been removed. There's shallow draft on some of those passages. The ice shifts from week to week and from month to month, as you say. In fact, even the floating ice can pose some significant navigational challenges. And part of the problem, of course, is that these areas are not under constant surveillance. I understand that more surveillance is being undertaken now with satellites and so forth. But the fact that, in fact, some passages have been made of the Northwest Passage by small ships without the knowledge of the Canadian authorities even, is an indication of how sparse the coverage is and how and what the multitude of challenges are that exist in these routes.
Now, your paper also talks about increasing competition from the traditional, transit points via Panama Canal and Suez Canal, and maybe a new one that's being built in Nicaragua.
Well, yes. I mean, I think there are a couple of things that people that need to be looked at to put this whole enthusiasm of the northern shipping routes in context. One is, as you say, the increasing upgrades to the infrastructure, the doubling of the Suez Canal, the widening of the Panama Canal, a dreamlike project to build this canal across Nicaragua, which may or may not happen, but the Chinese are involved, so maybe it will happen. So that's one thing. And the fact that there's a physical capacity is a factor, but of course there are also costs involved in terms of tolls and shippings. And even with the expansion of the Panama Canal, it still is not capable of handling the largest container ships. But the second thing one has to look at also are global shipping trends. In fact, the growth of global trade has slowed in the last few years. As trade slows, shipping slows. So that has been a factor. And also the increasing use to larger container vessels. So the volume has sort of peaked. There are larger but fewer vessels being used, which means that that also drives the economics. Bunker fuel prices are lower. So that also has to be factored in. So if one looks at the geography, of course, if you look at the globe and you take out your string or your tape measure, you can calculate quite easily the savings in distance. But do those savings in distance necessarily equate to a saving in costs? And there are many, many factors that go into that calculation. And at the moment, most of them do not indicate that the costs are driving users to consider the Northern Passages as a major alternative.
But you, in your paper, you mentioned something very interesting, that even a very moderate growth in shipment through the northern routes, the Northwest Passage, would dramatically change Canada's relationship with a trade relationship with its Asian partners. Can you explain that a bit more?
Yes. Now, while I have staked out the case for the fact that I don't think there's going to be any major changes significant uses of the Northwest Passage anytime soon, that doesn't mean that Canada, A, should be neglecting this route, and B, should not be taking advantage of its geographical positioning. Let's take China as an example. Well, China's not the only Asian country that's interested in the Arctic. You know, China is a major world power. I think it's a given that it's only going to play a larger and larger international role in the future. As a global power, it wants to extend its reach everywhere. And the example I used was the Antarctic, outer space, and of course the Arctic. And in fact, China has a legitimate interest in the Arctic, as do other countries. If the impact of climate change, in fact, significantly reduces the ice pack, that's going to have an environmental impact. So China, I think, has no difficulty in establishing some bona fides and having an interest. But China also has a strategic interest, a political interest. It is going to continue to sort of stir the pot on Arctic issues and demonstrate an issue in interest and so on. At the same time, Canada is trying to further deepen and enrich its ties with Asian countries, and China in particular. I think it's a pretty good guess that the Prime Minister will be paying a bilateral visit to China this fall when he goes to China for the G20 meetings. This is a natural area where Canada and China, and indeed with Japan and Korea, can develop some unique bilateral cooperation. Canada is trying to make inroads into the Pacific. There's these trade agreements that are under consideration, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and others. There are other forums that we're trying to get into and want to get into. But we are a key core player in the Arctic. We are a permanent member of the Arctic Council. These Asian countries, China, Japan, Korea, have now become observers of the Arctic Council. There's a whole agenda there that needs to be worked on, and I think it's a perfect opportunity for Canada to take the lead in developing its Asian dimension through the lens of its Arctic presence.
So what kind of shipping and trade links with the Asian continent you see using the Arctic Sea routes?
Well, I don't think it's going to be a major container route. The examples that we have from both Russia and from a couple of, I would say, isolated examples, but, you know, possibly test cases, is that there is going to be a role probably for the shipment of resources directly from the Arctic to Asian ports. So there have been already some test shipments from the area of Hudson's Bay through the Northwest Passage going west to China. There have been a number of shipments in the Russian Arctic. Gas shipments, and as the gas fields get further developed, there will likely be more shipments from, say, the mid-Arctic in Russia through the Bering Strait to Asia, and potentially for further development in the Canadian North. I mean, there are many issues that are being discussed about how Canada's going to get its resources to tidewater and to markets in Asia and so forth. There's a potential role, I think, for the North there. So, I mean, rather than actual transits, I think that you will find that the passage is used as a conduit for resources from resource exploitation in the north to Asian economies. And that won't be necessarily year-round, but there will be, I think, considerable growth of shipping there. That offers some economic opportunities from Canada, but also offers some challenges in terms of making this a viable and a safe route.
Now, what needs to happen before this can, logistically work?
Well, the infrastructure, I think, as it's fairly commonly known, is relatively scattered and sparse in the Canadian North. The government is taking some steps to address that through rejuvenation of the ice-breaking fleet. But I think part of the problem is that there's been more talk than action in terms of actually exercising the kind of jurisdiction which, in fact, ends up strengthening sovereignty in the Canadian North. And this is everything from search and rescue capacity to proper updating of navigational charts, to having a physical presence in the north, to be able to supply, to rescue, to do the kind of atmospheric forecasting and so forth that one would expect in a major shipping route area. So one can catch up and eventually try and get there, or one can foresee that this is going to happen and start investing now. And I think the idea of getting ahead of the curve is where Canada should be. Well, I think the one area that we could Canada could perhaps explore is using the vehicle of the Arctic Council, where, as I mentioned, it is a permanent member, and the Asian countries are observers, to develop these relationships. Now, the kind of bilateral S&T investment, environmental cooperation doesn't necessarily have to be under the umbrella of the Arctic Council, but the Arctic Council actually is a... how shall I put it? It's an asset that Canada has. The countries that have come as observers have agreed to play by the rules by UNCLOS and so forth. So Canada has a role as a leader. It can then leverage that, I think, and use it to further develop bilateral cooperation with the key Asian countries, and by those I mean China, Japan, and Korea. India and Singapore, of course, are also members of the observers of the Arctic Council. So I think, in addition to the issue of infrastructure and, you know, feet on the ground and actually basing some search and rescue capacity in the north and so forth, there's a role for soft diplomacy, for exploiting and developing that, and we're now undergoing a defense policy review. I hope the Arctic will figure in that. I presume that will be followed at some point by a foreign policy review, and I think the Arctic and Canada's role in the Arctic and its and the use of the Arctic as a bridge to Asia is something that should be put in the forefront.